This is Mark Sobel, U.S. Chairman, OMFIF. Today, I'm joined by a distinguished panel to discuss the implications of the midterm election results for U.S. economic policy going forward. I'm joined by Marcia Vandenberg, a fellow at Stanford University's Distinguished Careers Institute and former CEO of the Pacific Pension Institute, Professor Steve Hanke of Johns Hopkins, world-renowned for his thinking on currency reforms and monetary policy, George Hoguet, who served for many years as State Street Global Advisors as a senior leader for the firm on global capital markets and economic investment policy and portfolio management issues, and Christopher Smart, my good friend and former U.S. Treasury colleague, who also worked as a senior official in President Obama's NSC, and is now head of macroeconomic policy and geopolitical research at Barings. Welcome. I'm going to leave the panelists to speak to the issues, but perhaps I could launch with a general reflection. Our form of government, for our European listeners, has lots of checks and balances. Enacting legislation is not easy, even when the same party controls the executive branch in both chambers of Congress. It's also not easy when U.S. politics is polarized and centrism is not alive and well. In such an environment, let alone an executive-legislative split, little legislation can be expected to get done. Some say the American public loves divided government. Increasingly, executive branches turn to regulatory remedies, which in and of themselves can be painstaking. So with those personal reflections, let's turn one by one to fiscal, monetary, financial markets and regulation, and trade policies. And given time constraints, I'll ask one of you to lead off on a given topic, but fiscal is so broad, perhaps all can come in. On fiscal, I think the post-election conventional wisdom is that overall fiscal policy will be on hold for the next few years. But Marcia, can you lead us off with your overall outlook for fiscal policy and whether you agree with the conventional wisdom?
Well, thank you, Mark. I do. I think there'll be a lot of commotion on Capitol Hill, and we'll see what happens when the dust settles, but it's likely that fiscal policy is more or less on hold. But with that said, I can highlight, I think, three areas where we might expect a lot of debate. One is an infrastructure bill, and that may very well have bipartisan support. It was an issue in the 2016 presidential campaign. Both candidates favored up to $1 trillion infrastructure allocation. Mike Pence, the vice president, has since said that he would favor a bill being debated in the lame duck session. The problem in the context of the U.S. economy is that infrastructure is not an immediate stimulus. It doesn't have an immediate effect. It has a 2 to 3 year time lag. And that's an issue for infrastructure, for an infrastructure bill. The second is the debt ceiling. And I think we can expect a lot of ruckus, a lot of debate, a lot of even acrimonious debate around the debt ceiling. There is no debt ceiling in place. There is, but it's been suspended. And that deadline is March 1st, 2019. So presumably they'll have to take up the issue of the debt ceiling before that time. And I would just note that this is, by some accounts, sort of a paper-thin debt ceiling. It's something that gets debated a lot and dealt with a lot. It was raised, I think, 8 times in 2008, or 4 times in 2008 and 2009. It's been kicked back and forth and usually becomes more of a major issue when there's disagreement between the Congress and the administration on fiscal policy. The third is tax cuts, and I think we can be reasonably sure we will not see another round of tax cuts. By the same token, I don't think the Congress, the House with its majority Democrats, has enough to roll back the tax cuts that were enacted last year. They may try to address it in terms of the deficit, but it may be a difficult try if they try to raise taxes on, say, wealthier Americans. But it will be a case when all the factors relating back to the deficit are front and center in fiscal policy. And then I'd quickly add that all these spending bills must come through the Appropriations Committee, the House Appropriations Committee. It's a very powerful committee. The people on the committee are very influential. This is where Nancy Pelosi had her start, on Appropriations Committee. The ranking Democrat is a woman named Nita Lowry from Westchester, New York. She's been a member of Congress since 1989. She's well regarded. When Hillary stepped down to be Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton stepped down to be Secretary of State, Nita Lowry was the one who was asked if she wanted to run for that seat or be appointed for that seat. And she said no, she wanted to stay on the Appropriations Committee, given her senior rank. And I just add finally that while there's not much likelihood of any forward action in terms of outright legislation on the fiscal front, it is an opportunity for the Democrats to set a narrative for the 2020 election and a narrative around which party is the most responsible steward of the government and the people's money.
So outlook then is for big deficits, debt burdens to continue to rise, unless you believe the U.S. economy is going to go in some hugely upward trajectory for growth. And you mentioned the debt ceiling. Typically, Treasury has extraordinary measures that it can use that will extend the life beyond the date. But this was always something that we found curious in the executive branch, because we were just paying the bills that Congress had told us to pay, and that would cause us to hit the debt ceiling, and then Congress would criticize us for fiscal profligacy. But one of the joys of American policy. Christopher, America faces a challenge on entitlement spending, and with the soaring deficit, Senator McConnell said that entitlements would need to be cut, Social Security and Medicare. This became a flashpoint in the elections, as the Democrats said that to pay for tax cuts for the rich, now the Republicans would cut benefits for the poor. Do you see any prospects for movement on entitlement in the next few years?
Well, thank you for saving the easy question for me, Mark. The question I think is particularly difficult now because both the Republican Party, it seems to me, and the Democratic Party are going through a fairly dramatic rethinking of what they believe in terms of economic policy. The Republican Party, that is the party of Donald Trump, appears to be less focused on deficits than the party that, you know, John Boehner led in the House a few years ago. And the Democratic Party may well become the party of fiscal responsibility, but that has not necessarily been part of its narrative. I will say one thing, just to kind of get a wild prediction on the record. Difficult decisions in American political history have generally come when the House is divided and the Congress and President are from different parties, so that neither party really needs to own the downside of the outcome. So it is historically conceivable. If ever there were going to be a time where we tackled entitlement reform, it would be, I think, a time where we have divided power in Washington. Having said that, I noticed that Senate Leader McConnell is not running for re-election anytime soon. So that may make him give him a little breathing room on how to start raising some of these issues. But I've not heard anybody in and around the White House talking about entitlement reform and how that would be done. And it's still too early to know, I think, in terms of the configuration of power in the House and the Senate, what is possible. I would go back to what Marcia was saying earlier. I think both parties are going to kind of use things like the debt ceiling at some point during next year or a continuing resolution to use that as leverage on other things they care about, whether it's immigration or gun control or something else, and that economic policy will kind of be not a primary agenda item, but rather a secondary lever to use in pursuit of other issues.
Well, thank you. And obviously, if entitlements were put on the table, all the other aspects of tax and spending policy might also be put on the table with it. George, Marcia began to speak about infrastructure. There's widespread agreement the U.S. needs to spend more. But since we've been talking about fiscal policy, do you have any further thoughts for us? And in particular on infrastructure, could you share with us your thinking?
Yeah, thank you, Mark. Let me step back for a moment and just share three observations about this election, which I think will help frame the debate to some extent with regard to infrastructure spending. And the first just general point is that while the Democrats have picked up at least 30 seats in the House, their net pickup is well within historic norms. So given the outcome of the election in the Senate, I don't think this election should be seen as a mass repudiation of Trump's policies. And Republicans control both chambers in 32 states now. My own view is that the fundamental tensions that the Trump presidency reflects will persist and actually, I think, get worse. Second point is that, as Marcia and Chris alluded to, while the loss of the House will impede Trump's preferred legislative agenda, such as a middle-class tax cut, I don't think we should forget the fact that Republican gains in the Senate enhance the confirmation prospects of Trump's future judicial appointees. And the changing composition of the judiciary, I think, is going to be one of the most lasting impacts of the Trump presidency. And then the third point is, as is well known, is that the Democratic Party is divided, and what takes place in the coming months should be seen in the forthcoming race for the 2020 presidential election, with Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris, Cory Booker, among others, likely to announce their candidacies. So I think while it's unlikely that the House will bring impeachment charges based on the Emoluments Clause, the House Judiciary Committee will investigate Trump's business dealings and possible violations of that clause, and of course, other alleged improprieties like payments, hush money payments as well. So let me try to relate that a little bit now to the deficit and infrastructure spending. First point is that according to the CBO, this year, to 2019, the deficit, full employment deficit, best economy we've had in years, is like 4.6%. GDP. As Marcia and Chris alluded to, the parties to some extent seem to have switched positions with regard to deficit hawks and doves. And I think the ability to get something through on infrastructure is going to some extent be a function of the vehemence with which and likelihood of impeachment proceedings. So Nadler and others have made it very clear that the Mueller probe is something first and foremost on their minds. The Democratic agenda is quite long: health care, gun control, immigration, technical aspects of the Tax Act, provisions to that, and of course on the more liberal side, a single-payer health care and further voting rights protections. I think that if the chances of an infrastructure bill are 50-50, and if we see one, it's likely to be much less than the Democratic proposal, because there's profound disagreements as to how such a program should be financed, with the Democrats, of course, wanting to raise taxes and the Republicans preferring private sector funding.
Well, thank you for that. The president had, I think, earlier proposed $200 billion in infrastructure spending program for the next 10 years and thought it would catalyze up to $1.25 trillion from state and local governments and the private sector. I also know many questioned whether the catalytic aspects were realistic. And I thank you for broadening the debate out beyond economics. And I very much agree with the points you were making about the judiciary as a key legacy of Mr. McConnell. Turning to Steve, do you have any thoughts on what you've heard about fiscal policy? And then can we also turn to monetary policy? So as the U.S. economy strengthens, the Fed is tightening and running down its balance sheets. Some feel our pro-cyclical fiscal policy is further pressuring rates. The president's complained publicly about the independent Fed, and some say may want to fire Jay Powell. Meanwhile, the FOMC is pricing in one hike in December, three next year, taking into account very low U.S. unemployment and some signs of rising prices. Now, analysts are always going to debate whether the Fed is being too tight or too loose or just right, just as there's always going to be debates about the monetary policy regime, be it the targeting the interest rate or the quantity of money or inflation targeting or forward guidance, etc. So what is your take on how monetary policy may shape up with the midterms over and the presidential elections in 2 years? Is the Fed just going to continue to do what it wants to do? And are the president's critiques of the Fed going to influence monetary policy?
Well, thank you, Mark. Let me start by starting where you started, and that is fiscal policy, and just make a couple comments about divided government. From my point of view, divided governments are good in the context of the U.S. Three things that are important to keep in mind. With divided government, the rate of growth in real federal spending is usually lower than with unified governments. So that aspect comes into the infrastructure observation that George made. I think he's right on target. This big infrastructure program, I think, will probably have maybe a 50-50% chance of coming through, but much less than advertised. The second aspect of divided government is that major reforms tend to stick, because if there are any reforms, they have to be bipartisan. So if you look at big things like the Reagan tax cuts of 1981 and 86, that was a divided government, very divided. In the Clinton years, you had welfare reform. That was a divided government context. And that comes, by the way, into the entitlements. If there are any reforms, they'll probably be sustained and be things that stick. The third thing is that the prospect of war, a major war, actually declines with divided governments. All the major wars in the 20th century in the United States, with the exception of the Iraq War, were all with unified governments. All Democrats, it turned out. As I say, the exception to the whole thing is the Iraq War we recently have experienced. So that's my general take. I happen to think in an optimistic perspective when I see a divided government in the U.S. As far as monetary growth and the monetary policy is concerned, Mark, what I call a golden growth rate, one that's consistent with a 2% rate of inflation, is a broad money, and that, I mean, M4, the broadest measure that we have that the Center for Financial Stability puts out. The optimum rate is about 4.4%, and the current growth rate's about 4.2%. It's been coming down, actually. It's tightening up. At the start of the year, it was about 5% broad money growth, and it's come down quite a bit. So when you look at the money supply as a monetarist, tightening and a little on the tightish side, as a supply-sider, if you look at prices, the most important price in the world is the dollar-euro rate. And right now, the dollar is very strong. I mean, it's trading 1.127 this morning, I just checked. My lower end on that scale would be about 120. 120 to 140 is kind of the optimum range, and we're way stronger than that right now, suggesting a lot of tightness. Gold, the optimum range I have is about $1,200 an ounce to $1,400 an ounce. We're at 1205 this morning, so it's, again, very signaling a price that's very tight. This is what supply siders look at. Oil, right now, my models indicate that we should be at around $70 to $75 a barrel on West Texas Intermediate, and we're trading at $61. So the commodity prices, the currency markets, the global liquidity dollar squeeze that we're in, all the prices indicate actually quite a bit of tightness. The money supply, moderate tightness. So, in short, we're pretty tight, but if we look at aggregate demand and the economy itself, it's pretty hot. I mean, the trend rate of growth in nominal terms for aggregate demand, final sales to domestic purchasers, is about 4.8%, and we're growing at about 5.7% right now. So where does this all leave me? It leaves me more or less where the Fed is and where the consensus is. They probably will make one more rate move on the upside by the end of the year, but it's not completely in the bag because of all this tightness that already exists and the fact that we have definitely a global liquidity squeeze on the dollar. Dollars are very scarce overseas, and that's one reason the dollar is so strong. There's been a lot of repatriation of after the tax bill was changed, and there's been repatriation of foreign U.S. dollar funds by U.S. corporations. So there's not much liquidity in dollar terms overseas right now. So I think this, all these things would make me fairly cautious if I was at the Fed. I mean, I look at the economy, the real economy is pretty hot, but you look at all the other price and monetary supply measures, and they indicate that they're already pretty tight, winding this balance sheet down. So there you have my take on things as far as the money supply. And as I say, divided government, I think I would be more inclined toward George's comments in the sense that I think divided government's a good thing, not a bad thing.
Following up on Steve's comments, if you look at the Federal Reserve dot plot, that market expectations continue to be below the dot plot as they have been for several months.
I think that's right. I think the market's pricing in about a 75% plus probability of a hike for December. But for next year, some of the dot plots are just three hikes. I think the market had been at one, but has now moved up to two hikes. But again, I think it will be very much data dependent. The Fed is very pragmatic. And I take it implicitly from Steve's remark, and now I'm going to turn to George, but I take it from Steve's remarks that you don't see the president's criticisms influencing the Fed's course of monetary policy, but rather that the Fed will be data dependent. And George, do you have any thoughts for us on monetary policy beyond what you just offered us, as well as financial markets? And then let me turn to the regulatory policy front and financial regulation in particular. I said in the outset that the executive branch has considerable power over regulation. Deregulation has been a key Republican mantra. There's been talk about rollback in financial regulation. Obviously, the House under Democratic leadership will have a different take on financial regulation than the Senate under Republican control. And could you tell us where you think all this is headed and what might be the administration's regulatory or deregulatory priorities for the next 2 years?
Sure. Let me just address first the issue of Fed policy. And my own view is that Trump's objections will, of course, not influence Fed policy. But that being said, one has to bear in mind that the Fed has three main constituencies, Wall Street, Main Street, and the presidency, and they will have to carefully navigate in the months ahead. With regard to regulatory policy, I think one impact of the election, of course, is that Trump will try to focus on those issues where he can, through executive action alone, achieve desired outcomes. So this is going to mean things like the EPA, you know, rolling back regulations dealing with wetlands or pollution of one sort or another. We've already had recommendations with regard to fuel economy. He issued the two-for-one decree, if I could put it that way, that regulatory agencies had to remove two regulations for every one that they put forward. So I think that he will increasingly focus in that area. But as you alluded to, Mark, even in that area, it sometimes takes longer to get things done than one might think. In terms of the financial services industry, of course, Randy Quarles recently suggested that the Fed might relax some of the constraints with regard to banks, and particularly SIFIs. So I would anticipate that the deregulation efforts will continue to roll forward, and while some of them may be challenged in the courts, that this would be a priority for the Trump administration going forward.
Well, thank you for that. Let me finally turn to Christopher on trade policy. Christopher has a bit of experience in this realm, and trade policy is all over the news. We know the U.S. has slapped tariffs on China and is threatening to up the amount of the tariffs and impose new ones on the rest of the U.S.-China bilateral trade. There's a bit of a truce with Europe, and the new NAFTA deal is yet to be signed. Many think the Democrats are just as split on trade policy as the Republicans, and that many Democrats are happy to see China pressured. So, Christopher, do you think the midterms have major implications for trade, or will it be status quo? And what does your crystal ball tell us about President Trump's upcoming meeting at the G20?
You know, I think, as you said, trade policy is all over the news. I think it's also politically all over the map. And a lot of that is because President Trump has run on a platform of delivering a good trade deal after so much bad trade negotiations by prior administrations. I mean, I think that's the theme that he comes back to again and again. And what will be interesting is the extent to which the renegotiation of NAFTA, the USMCA, if I'm not mistaken, is able to, you know, has a better or a worse fate in Congress because of the people or the constituencies that the president is able to bring along. As you pointed out, Mark, trade policy has been very controversial for Democrats for a long time, and it is now increasingly controversial for Republicans. Interesting question whether the president's brand on saying this is a better trade deal, no matter what many of us looking at it would say, very much looks like TPP. But the fact that he is able to say, no, this is a trade deal that protects American workers better, delivers on American interests, and puts America first, I think he probably has a better than even chance of bringing on a lot of Democrats who might have been less willing to support something brought by a Republican administration. This is a trade deal that is marginally more supportive of labor interests, you could argue, and labor unions have in general been saying warm things about it. In terms of broader relations with trade issues with Europe, it does seem like those have been put on the back burner for now and will come out from time to time as the president feels like he wants to escalate tensions with Europe or reinforce his domestic political base. But I think it's hard to see either real tariffs being slapped on European cars coming into the country or dramatic new progress on revised accelerated trade agenda with Europe. I think what's easier to foresee is continued friction with China, because I think that is something that both Republicans and Democrats are concerned about. And even though in Argentina you may get a temporary truce or an agreement to maybe appoint a commission that will examine some of these details, these broader structural issues in more detail, will give you a pause in terms of rhetoric or the rolling out of further tariffs, I think we're headed over the longer term for more friction, more tariffs, and more measures and countermeasures. The next step, once we put tariffs on everything, will be, I think, Chinese authorities doing more to harass U.S. firms doing business in China, and we will probably find ways of doing the same thing to Chinese firms investing in the U.S.
That's very cheerful. This has been a very rich discussion, and so I've tried to have everybody comment on one area, even though all of you have undoubtedly brilliant thoughts about all of the areas. So in that spirit, maybe I could ask, if I gave each of you 1 minute, do you have further thoughts for us, and particularly on some of the areas on which you didn't comment? So 1 minute each. Marcia, can you lead us?
Sure, Mark. I want to step back from the debate Dems versus the Republicans and look at the issue and comment on the issue of leadership. And this may be hope over reality, but my hope is that there can be some emphasis on the importance of the legislation rather than the political gain. And I think this is more possible in the area of trade than it is perhaps with fiscal policy, although around items like the infrastructure bill, it could be, there could be some legitimate progress. I just would mention that in the area of trade, the NAFTA to the China tariff, the confrontation really with China now, the European trade agreement and so on. There's many issues that the Democrats and the Republicans agree with, and I don't need to enumerate them. I think everyone's pretty well aware of that. But the point is that we need to get to some place where we are working again with the Chinese, where we are working again with the Europeans, where we have resolved some of the, we still have an economy that's part of a global economy. To sum up, my hope is that there is leadership that gets exerted in Congress. We have a different constellation of politics, and there's an opportunity to rise above the acrimony, at least on one or two or three issues. And I, being in California, I think, go back to what Nancy Pelosi said on election night. And she said, you know, we're all tired of this acrimony. What we want is peace. And I think she's right.
Steve?
Well, in that spirit, we'll see if Trump is as smart as Clinton was, because once the Congress became divided, and of course we had Newt Gingrich versus Bill Clinton, Clinton was smart enough to figure out what to do. And he not only performed very well on the fiscal front, better than any post-World War II president in terms of controlling government spending, but he also accomplished some significant reforms that stuck. So maybe there is a model for what should be done in these divided government contexts. The other big point that I would make is that money dominates. Whatever happens to the money supply will dominate the fiscal stance of the United States. And to get that one, the easiest thing to look at is that Japan, they have had very loose fiscal policy for many, many moons and very tight monetary policy. And the economy struggles along at a slowly kind of quasi-deflationary stance because of tight money. So we have tight money, loose fiscal. The tight money will dominate.
George?
Well, I'd comment on a couple of areas. There seems to be some emerging consensus that if the Republicans and Democrats in the Congress are going to work together, the two areas that would be most likely would be infrastructure, drug prices, and possibly immigration. But I'm not particularly optimistic, because I do believe that any legislative initiatives in this session of Congress will be overshadowed by the inquiries that will take place by the Democrats on various aspects of the Trump presidency. Second point I want to make is that this expansion is long by historic norms. And while expansions don't die of old age, obviously a shock of one sort or another, particularly, let's say, the financial crisis in China or a spike in oil prices or whatever, could impact the U.S. economy, and the fiscal situation of the U.S. could significantly deteriorate. So my point here is that it's quite possible that we could be facing a downturn in economic activity in excess of the expected slowdown in growth rate over the next 2 years. And then the third point is that, coming back to monetary policy, we potentially could be in a situation where financial markets are selling off, but the Fed, based on the data that's coming in, will feel obligated to raise rates. So there's tremendous amount of uncertainty, it seems to me, both in the monetary area and in terms of congressional actions.
The last word from Christopher Smart.
Well, I'm not sure I can provide a lot more clarity on any of this. The risk I think all of us have is focusing on the political realm, which may be less decisive in the economic cycle than we think it is. Tariffs and trade wars are obviously not helpful. The potential for standoff in Congress over the debt limit or a continuing resolution would obviously not be helpful. I think mostly, as others have said, broader patterns in the cycle, monetary policy, fiscal policy, and corporate profits are going to be what drives the extension of the current growth cycle or whether or not we're heading into a recession.
Well, thank you for that. So thanks to all for a very stimulating discussion on U.S. economic policy after the midterm elections. Marcia Vandenberg, Steve Hanke, George Hoguet, and Christopher Smart, our greatest appreciation. Thank you.